And to a whale, the idea of crossing an ocean is, well, you might say it's a whole different kettle of fish. For instance, the Pacific gray whales. Every year they feed in the plankton-rich waters off Kodiak Island in Alaska. And then they swim thousands of miles south to mate and give birth in protected lagoons off the coast of Mexico. In these home waters, they also welcome human visitors, people like Brenda Peterson. She's a novelist, a nature writer, a journalist. She went to Baja with her frequent collaborator, Chicksaw poet and novelist Linda Hogan. And together they've written a book called Sightings. It's about the gray whales, their migration, and the experience of meeting them. When Brenda Peterson talked with Steve Paulson, she recalled one special day in Mexico.
We were following the mother-calf pairs in a little skiff that was about 18 feet long, and suddenly we saw coming toward us what the scientists say is the friendly whale syndrome. And I thought, I really hope they're serious about this friendly whale, because that whale was about as long as a semi-truck. It was 45 tons, and it came straight for our little skiff, full of children and women and an elderly gentleman with crutches. And that beautiful mother whale came straight toward us, stopped very, very carefully, lifted our boat up on her knuckled back, and spun us around very slowly as if to say, oh, our float toys, they're here.
Spun you around? That's amazing. Without obviously with no intention of dumping you out. I mean, she knew exactly what she was doing.
Since the 70s, these whales have been exhibiting this curious engagement with humans that, as I say, the scientists call the friendly whale syndrome. I think it might be also the friendly people syndrome, because for 70 years we haven't hunted the gray whale, and therefore there is an interspecies bond and a trust that has been restored with this leviathan of the seas.
What was that experience like for you as you watched this whale come toward you? I mean, did you ever have any eye contact?
Absolutely. Their eyes are as big as softballs. They're brown. They're unblinking. Someone once said that whale watching takes on a whole new meaning when the whale is watching you. And we were being watched.
You are describing a very mysterious creature, and I'm sure there are lots of things that scientists still don't understand about gray whales, but there are things that we do know about them. For instance, they are bottom feeders.
They are.
What do they do? How do they eat?
We were very fortunate up in Alaska to see bottom feeding firsthand. It's unusual to be able to witness it. We were out over the continental shelf off Kodiak Island, and 50 fathoms deep. We really shouldn't have been out there, but it was such a glorious, calm day. It happened to be June 21st, 2000, the first summer solstice of the new century. And we were afloat out there when we saw tier after tier after tier of gray whales coming up from the very bottom of the ocean with these huge maws, their mouths, their baleen, streaming mud, amphipods, the little tiny creatures they feed on, and coming straight up out of the water. The smell was amazing, considering that there's no smell in Baja because they don't feed. So the breath there was quite sweet and fresh. And up in the Arctic, it was very pungent. It was like swamp gas. And the mist came over our boats, and we were in the middle of 400 gray whales feeding. So we do know that in this extraordinary shoveling of the bottom of the ocean, they stir up the plant life. And one thing that Linda writes about is the plankton and the crucial plant life of the ocean. 80% of the world's oxygen comes from the plant life in the ocean. So by their shoveling and plowing of the bottom, they actually contribute, these gray whales, to photosynthesis.
So you're saying that these gray whales swim along the bottom and basically use their mouths as shovels, and the baleen filters get the sediment out, so they're just eating what they want to eat.
Yes, and any kind of plowing, as you know, in our land plowing, it fertilizes, it turns over the soil, in this case the ocean bottom, and that kind of constant turnover helps the photosynthesis of the plant life. And so eventually, when you really think about it, we are connected by the very air that we breathe that the gray whales make possible.
You mentioned that gray whales don't eat in Baja, where they mate and give birth, but they swim to Alaska. I mean, we're talking an enormous migration.
It's the most majestic migration of any land or sea animal that we know of. 10,000 to 12,000 miles round trip. They feed up in the Arctic. They fill their stomachs, their three-chambered stomachs, full, and then they swim 5,000 miles to Baja to mate and give birth. And then they swim all the way back up to the Arctic to feed again. And it's why we're so worried about the crash or the decline in the population. In the last 7 years, they've gone from this success story of 26,000 down to only 17,000. And the calves have plummeted, the birth of the calves in the lagoons have plummeted from a high of about 1,500 to only 400. So we are very concerned about this decline over such a short time.
Why would gray whales make such an arduous journey? I mean, why swim all these thousands of miles?
Well, if you were a native person, you might say that they did it for the oceans, that they are the health of the oceans, and they go up and down the coast in these shallow bottom feedings, helping our oceans to breathe. That's what the native people told us. It's also what science tells us. In terms of why, we need more time to study. We know they've been doing it for thousands of years. 60 million years these grays have been evolving. They're some of the oldest of the fossils of whales that have been found.
Now, as I was reading your book, I came across some remarkable facts. I mean, for instance, the evolutionary history of the gray whale is quite interesting. These were creatures that once walked on land many millions of years ago.
We always speak of them as our mammal cousins. You know, they went back to the sea, and we came out of the sea. We are younger than they are evolutionarily. But if you look at a gray whale skeleton, as I've unfortunately had a lot of opportunity to see, you see these amazingly kind of poignant skeletal hands inside their pectoral fins, those five long fingers left over from when they were land creatures. And then if you go back toward the end of their skeleton, you see these tiny little vestigial limbs that were legs 30 million years ago. So you really do see not only a connection because we both breathe air and nurse our young on milk, you see the fact that they are like us in the fact that they have these hands inside their fins. And I never forget that when I reach out and actually am lucky enough to touch a great gray whale.
Are gray whales very different from other kinds of whales, other species?
Jean-Michel Cousteau, Jacques Cousteau's son, who was there the first year in Baja filming a documentary on the gray whales, he calls them breathing planets. And I really love that description. I've spent 20 years with dolphins and orcas and humpbacks and came to the gray whales. They're not very charismatic in the sense that orcas might be or spinner dolphins, but they have a kind of enigma and a kind of majesty and gentleness that I am captured by, because when they come to you and make this kind of contact, there's a great humility in it. And you also have to think about the fact that they are whales who have twice come to the brink of extinction by human hands, and that along the coast as they go up, they will be hunted. So I think they're humanity. I would call it humanity and give that to that species, that they keep reaching out even though we are a fairly schizophrenic species in our behavior toward them. On one hand, we reach out with our hands, we weep, we promise them, the children call to them, and then up the coast, they come to the boat and they're met with a harpoon.
Up the coast, you're talking about the tribal hunters?
I'm talking about some of the tribal hunters, and if Japan and Norway have their way, a return to commercial harvesting of grays in the 21st century.
Let me ask you about tribal hunting. I mean, if we're just talking about the gray whales along the Pacific coast, it's a very controversial subject, of course. Why do the tribes hunt them?
Traditionally, they have hunted them for thousands of years in sustainable balance and also in a spiritual balance. Doing this book with a Native American co-author was very important because it really is a discussion that's deeper than sound bites. It's about sovereign nations and sacred balance of all species. And one of the things that Linda brings up in her very poignant and passionate appeal to Native people is that we really have to look at what the treaty rights are that we've made between ourselves and other species, as well as the rights we've made between ourselves as humans. The First Nations, you could say, were the animals. In many Native stories, the first peoples were animal, and then they changed into human. So we have not only a connection through this kind of Native science and storytelling, but the whalers of the past, as Linda writes about very beautifully, were very noble. They had a deep relationship with the gray whale. And in fact, the Macaw tribe was the first to stop whaling when they saw the devastation of the Yankee whalers. So every discussion about Native whaling has to take into account not just the peoples on the shore, but the peoples of the ocean, who include the gray whales.
Brenda Peterson is the co-author with Linda Hogan of Sightings, The Gray Whale's Mysterious Journey. Steve Paulson spoke with her.